Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine Podcast Radio. Join us on our journey into the past, the present, and the future as we explore the relationship between technology and humanity. Together, we are going to find out what it means to live in a society where everything is connected and the only constant is change. Knowledge is power, now more than ever. Black Cloak provides concierge cybersecurity protection to corporate executives and high net worth individuals to protect against hacking, reputational loss, financial loss, and the impact of a corporate data breach. Learn more at blackcloak.io. RSA Security offers business-driven security solutions that provide organizations with a unified approach to managing digital risk that hinges on integrated visibility, automated insights, and coordinated actions. Learn more at rsa.com.
Marco.
Sean.
Are you ready to learn something?
I'm ready to go for a quest.
A quest? A quest for learning.
A quest for avoiding me to have to learn. And looking for something that is going to do it for me so I can just sit on the couch and everything is going to be resolved.
We want everything to be done for us. So why not have something learned for us too, right?
Exactly.
Nice. Well, we're going to take a journey toward that quest and talk about the master algorithm and the quest for such a thing. And I have no idea what that is. Sounds fun. Sounds fun. But thankfully, as with most of these
things, happens.
Exactly.
It often happens.
I'm not very smart and I need help. And hopefully there's something in my brain that connects with our audience's questions as well.
Well, look, Sean, there's the famous quote in the Harry Potter series where it says, if you have doubts, go to the library, by Hermione Granger, one of the characters. And so our point is, if we have doubts and we want to learn something, let's call somebody that wrote a book about it.
Exactly.
And that's exactly, again, what we did today. So who's our guest?
So today we have Pedro Dominguez, and he is the author of The Quest for the Master Algorithm. Pedro, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So the title is interesting, but let's start with what motivates you, maybe your background and how you decided to write this book. So what do you do?
Well, I'm a professor of computer science and my specialty is machine learning. That's what I got my PhD in all those decades ago. And I've been doing that ever since. And I wrote this book because I just felt there was a pressing need for a book introducing machine learning to a broad audience. We're at the point where machine learning touches everybody's lives, right? You're constantly interacting with machine learning in small things and in large ones. And it's not enough for just the experts to know about machine learning, because very important decisions on a personal, professional, and societal level have to do with machine learning. And you know, I kept seeing all these very uninformed takes on machine learning. And people, including CEOs and presidents, making not very good decisions. So I thought, somebody has to do this. And so I decided to do it.
Good. And the first question that may come in mind, and I'm trying to maybe think with the brain of our audience, is we often hear about artificial intelligence. There's a ton of books about artificial intelligence, and we know machine learning is part of that, but some people may get confused. So could we maybe clarify what is the relationship between the two to get started?
Yeah, for sure. AI is trying to get computers to do the things that normally require human intelligence. Things like problem solving and reasoning and common sense and language understanding, speech understanding, vision, manipulation, navigation. One of the most important capabilities that humans have is the ability to learn. And so machine learning is the goal. The goal of machine learning is to automate learning in the same way that natural language processing automates language understanding and so on. The reason it's become so important, almost to the point where people just confuse the two, is that in the same way that in humans, learning drives everything else. Today in AI, machine learning drives everything else. It's because we now have much better machine learning algorithms than we did 20 years ago that we have vision systems and language systems and everything else that do what they do. So machine, you know, one way to think about this is that machine learning is the engine that drives AI, and the fuel is data.
I love that that visual to help us kind of connect what the pieces parts are. So an algorithm then does it sit? It may even sit in the data. I don't know. Does it sit at each of those points, or is it strictly in the learning part, and AI has something else other than an algorithm?
Well, the beauty of machine learning is that it's an algorithm that creates algorithms. That's really what the whole innovation is, and the beauty of machine learning, and the reason I find it fascinating and why it's so powerful, is that the same learning algorithm can do an infinity of different things, provided you give it the appropriate data to learn from. This is something new under the sun, right? You know, computers can do anything, as Alan Turing explained, but you have to program them to do that. If you want the computer to play chess, you have to program it to play chess. If you want the computer to fly an airplane, you have to program it to fly the airplane, or, you know, manage payroll. You know, you have to write different programs to do these different things, which takes a long time and is costly and so on. The amazing thing about machine learning is that, no, the same learning algorithm is today doing all of these things, because you just gave it, you know, if you give it chess games, it learns to play chess. If you give it a person driving a car, it learns to drive a car, and all of these things are real applications. So, you know, a learning algorithm is a master algorithm, and hence the title of the book, in the same sense that a master key opens all the locks, right? So it's one algorithm that can do, you know, all the different things in the same way that a master key can open all the different locks.
So in with that in mind then, so humans, at least for the moment, are behind the keyboards telling the algorithms how to algorithm. And I'm wondering, so as it's learning, do we then have the control, and should we have the desire to control what it learns, what it doesn't learn, what it remembers, what it forgets? Or does that just happen regardless?
No, that is a key question, right? In some ways, it's the key question. So the question is, if you just let an algorithm go learn, how do you control what it does? Because, you know, we don't have learning algorithms just for them to go do whatever random thing or crazy thing they want to do, right? We still want them to do this for a purpose, right? And the answer to that question actually has a very definite answer, which is that every learning algorithm, and in essence, every AI algorithm, has what is called an objective function. The objective function is what it's trying to optimize, is its goal. And what you do is you tell the algorithm, here's your goal. Now, how you pursue it is up to you. But I'm going to judge you by how well you do on this goal. And the goal could be predictive accuracy. It could be click-through rate. It could be, you know, return rate on some investment. It can be engagement, right? In social media, very saliently these days, you know, the goal is engagement. So you actually define for the algorithm, you manually, right? The learning algorithm is still written by us, right? And although there's also things called meta-learning, but in essence, the learning algorithm is written by us. And in a way, the most important thing that you write is the objective function. And then all this power of this massive data and massive compute, you know, is going to be put in the service of that goal. So our goal is, our role as humans is to set the goals and then monitor the system to check that it is achieving our goals. And in fact, the system internally, a lot of what machine learning consists of, it's like the scientific method on steroids. It's generating hypotheses and discarding them very quickly, because the ones that satisfy the goal best win and the others lose. The reason AlphaGo got to, you know, be such a superhuman player is that, you know, it was playing against itself, and the objective function is, you know, number of wins, right? And it was generating data, you know, essentially without limit, with the goal of playing better.
Yeah, and which is also the big issue about the fear connected with the artificial intelligence, the Skynet, right? You know, how do you keep control of all of this? What if it misinterprets the goal that you have assigned? And in order to achieve that goal, is going to take action that are not really friendly towards human. But without going into that, because I feel like we're really jumping already really deep into this, let's go with some examples. And you have plenty, I know, in the book on how from the moment we wake up in the morning to the moment we go to bed, we are already interacting with machine learning and algorithm, and that this concept of the future is coming, it's more of a fact of the future is already here. It's just in what size. So let's give a general introduction to algorithm in our daily life, and I think that's going to be fun.
Yeah, as William Gibson says, the future is already here. It's just unevenly distributed. But the other aspect of that is that awareness of the future is very unevenly distributed. One of the most common reactions that I get from people to the book is, wow, I thought this was science fiction, and you're telling me that it's actually already happening. And it is, and people need to be aware of it. So, for example, every time you do a web search, there's a learning algorithm that chooses what to show to you. And depending on the data that it has, it also personalizes search results. So it's actually a really good thing, right? The search results that I get will be different from yours because they're based on my interests. You know, Twitter. There's basically an algorithm in Twitter that decides what everybody sees. Who gets to see what tweets, right? So in the information that you get is being controlled by a learning algorithm. Again, it's trying to figure out what you're interested in based on your likes and your engagements in general. Same thing with Facebook, right? Facebook is basically a big machine learning system controlling who sees what. Another big one is product recommendations. Amazon recommender system is responsible for, I think, like a third of what people buy there. And the Netflix recommender system is responsible for 3/4 of the movies that people watch on it, right? This goes even as far as dating sites, right? You know, most marriages today in America start on the internet, or a very large fraction of them, I forget the exact number. So there are children alive today that wouldn't have been born if a machine learning algorithm hadn't recommended that their parents go on a date. So this is how important, you know,
your godfather is the algorithm.
or the matchmaker, you know, like in the old days, there was the village matchmaker who said like, oh, you know, this girl should talk to this boy. And you know, the matchmaker in the global village is machine learning algorithms. And the reason,
no bias there, of course.
No, none. Yeah. but I think, you know, like this, actually dating in particular illustrates why machine learning has become so important is that the internet creates a global village where you can read infinite books and meet infinite people. But then you, of course, are not humanly able to go look at all of them, right? You can't look at, you know, every one of the millions of people in whatever New York City to decide who to date. So you need machine learning is kind of like an almost inevitable consequence of the internet. You have all this choice. You need something to help you make the choice, right? I'm not at Barnes & Noble, so instead of 10,000 books, I have 10 million. But I can't look at 10 million books, so the machine learning, so hopefully, selects, you know, here's 100 that you might want to look at, and then I choose from those.
And then it goes into driving, it goes to the map route, it goes into the music that you listen, the exercise that you do more and more, right?
Exactly. Everywhere, I think the mental model that people should have is that everywhere there's data, there is, or there will soon be, machine learning. Right, a car has, I don't know how many microprocessors in it. Like a car is like a pile of computers. They're all generating data. And then, you know, everything is being optimized from the injection to optimize fuel efficiency to the route that is being recommended for you to follow. So your whole life from who, you know, was recommended that you date to the restaurant that you then pick using Yelp to the route that the car then goes on to the, you know, to the driving being optimized. All of this involves machine learning. And then, of course, larger societal things these days are also done with machine learning. For example, voters are targeted using machine learning. A lot of cities are using machine learning to optimize, you know, how different urban systems work, from transportation to power distribution, et cetera, et cetera.
So let's talk about the element fueling all of this, and that's the data, as you pointed out earlier. And in the context of data, I mean, it can learn if it's there. I don't know if it can learn if it's not. But I'm wondering how we as humans interact with the algorithm by providing our data. And so I guess I'm wondering, how does it get generated? How does it get collected? How much of it is human specifically provided versus just exhaust that we're putting off digitally? And yeah, well, let's start there, because I think probably a million directions we could take it after that. But how does the data get generated, and how much interaction does a human have?
Yeah, in the old days, people would put together a data set and then learn from it. And there's a lot of statistical theory about how to do that. What you get with that is small data sets that you can't learn that much from. What you have today and what's causing this revolution is that data is being generated for its own sake, for its own purposes. And there's a side effect of these processes that are going on. We now have something that we can learn from. But that data was not created for the purpose of learning. So the good thing about this is that it's enormous amount of data that you can potentially do amazing things with. The downside is that data has all sorts of crap in it. And the lesson, I think, here for most people is that you have to remember, and I do this every time I use Google or Twitter or Amazon or Netflix, that everything you do has actually two roles. One is, you know, I clicked on something, I got what I wanted. That was the immediate role. But also has a larger and ultimately more important role is that with every one of those things that I do, I am teaching the machine about me. So you have to think about what you're teaching it, right? If you don't want it to teach it something, then maybe you shouldn't do that. One of my arguments in the book is, and in general, is that we actually should have more control over how the machine learning works, right? But the companies have been very shy about doing this. And I think it will only happen, you know, by popular demand, if you will. Right? I should be able to tell the machine things that, you know, I don't want it to do or that I'm not interested in, as opposed to it just trying to figure out what I want. Which, of course, this being AI, its intelligence is not that great, right? Despite all the progress that we've made, you know, Amazon doesn't know that, hey, I just bought a watch, so please stop showing me ads for watches because, you know, like, I'm clearly not going to buy another one, right? So there's a lot of things like that.
So there is one quote, I think, in the book where you compare the algorithm as, or the computer, and they use the algorithm as a master craftsman, right? That it creates, is an artisan that takes things, in this case, data, instead of gold and wood and all of that, and it creates the things that we need. But it actually, you're telling the machine, the algorithm, to just go and be creative. So it kind of breaks with that idea of computers only do what you tell them to do. You're empowering an artifact that you have made to just now go on your own.
Yeah.
It's philosophical heavy, this one here.
There's this famous quote by Picasso that, you know, computers can't create, right? They're boring because they don't, I forget how it goes. They don't answer questions. They don't ask questions. They only answer them.
Yeah.
They right. And a lot of people do have this image, and I understand where it comes from, as computers that are just these rigid machines that do what you program them to do, because that's how it used to be. But the whole thing about machine learning is that it's actually, for better or worse, it's the computers being creative. The computers are synthesizing things from the data that they have, in the same way that an artist does. And in fact, there's a lot of good art these days being created by computer. Again, many people say, oh, the one thing that will never be automated is, you know, music or literature, or actually those things are already being done by computers. Literature, not very well, but news stories are generated by computers these days. And certainly there's fairly respectable visual art created by computers. So computers actually are able to create, in a way, what a machine learning algorithm is a recipe for creating things. It's like, you know, imagine teaching someone to be a sculptor, right? You don't know what they're going to sculpt, but you teach them the techniques of how to take a block of marble and so on. And in essence, that's what a machine learning researcher does, is teaches the algorithm to sculpt, and then you give it data, and then you see what it sculpts with that data.
So the cool thing is we may end up with some interesting things that we wouldn't have otherwise built or created if it was only humans. The question I have is, because you use the Amazon example where you just bought a watch and yet they're still showing you watch ads. presumably Amazon can figure that out eventually, and that algorithm would fix itself to not show you watches anymore, or maybe the upgraded one is the one that they should be showing you. But when we start to look at the bigger picture, does Google have that same analysis, that data and the results of that algorithm's output? Does Apple? Does the government? And what I'm wondering is how, because the title of the book and the conversation is the master quest for the master algorithm. So I'm wondering, is it the quest for a single algorithm that we all use, or is it a race for the best based on commercial viability and the need to make a buck, because that's what we do as humans?
Yeah, well, what is the race for the master algorithm? Right, a lot of what the book is about is that there are these major paradigms in machine learning. They're very interesting because each of them comes from a different field of science. So the most popular one these days is deep learning, which is learning based on how the brain works. But you can also have learning based on evolution, learning based on analogy, learning based on automating the scientific method, as I mentioned earlier, learning based on ideas from statistics. And there's, you know, thousands these days, millions of people working with each of these types of learning. And again, each of these has a claim to being a very general learning algorithm. For example, backpropagation, which is the leading neural network algorithm, these days is literally used for just about anything. And my point, however, is that none of these algorithms is quite universal. It aspires to be universal, but each of these paradigms has some problems that it solves very well, but others that it doesn't. And my point is that a truly universal learning algorithm can't just solve some of the problems. It has to solve all of them, or it's not universal. And on a practical level, we need it for the applications that we want to do, like, you know, to have a home robot, to have a cure for cancer, to have self-driving cars, to have all these things. We need a truly universal algorithm. And a lot of other people do believe that algorithm is within reach. One way to go about it is to unify these paradigms and have something like a grand unified theory of machine learning, in the same way that there's a grand unified theory of physics or a central dogma in biology. And in a way, that is really what the dream of the master algorithm is.
Does that mean one grand master goal set for the algorithm?
No, exactly. Absolutely not. So it's one algorithm, but one of the inputs to that algorithm, as I describe in the book, is the objective function. My role, I, as the machine learning researcher, who maybe, hopefully, will come up with a master algorithm, is not to have a master objective function, because there isn't one, and God forbid. The master algorithm accepts an objective function as a subroutine. And that objective function is provided by the user. So even though it's one learning algorithm, there'll be millions or billions of different versions of it with millions of different, like, you know, my company is optimizing my objective, and my subdivision, for different tasks, there will be different objectives. So it's one algorithm, but it's an infinity of different objective functions.
So is the method that you're going for, like the perfect method of executing this learning and applying? So that's what refer to the master.
Yeah. So what is this algorithm doing at the end of the day? It's taking an objective function and a pile of data and creating an algorithm that optimizes the objective function based on the pile of data. And how it does that, well, that's what the learning algorithm, that's what our job as machine learning researchers is to come up with that. Then the data scientist will apply that algorithm or variations of that algorithm to different data sets with different objectives and get the corresponding results.
And so it can be applied to, of course, cure for cancer, medical research, and depending on what data you're feeding, which it's impossible not to have a reference with the way that we work as human. I mean, no, there is a reason why it's been called artificial intelligence and not artificial something else, because it kind of resembles the way that we interact with each other, right? The way we learn.
Well, some paradigms in machine learning are pretty close to what humans do, but others are very different. So this is why there are different paradigms. Again, a lot of learning, much of which I think is some of the best, is quite directly inspired by psychology or by neuroscience. But there's also, and I would actually say this is the majority view in machine learning, that, well, you know, humans are a part of evolution and evolution is a mess. So what we should do is figure out from first principles how you should learn, right? It's a mathematical, logical, almost philosophical approach to learning. And that's what, for example, Bayesianism, right? Bayesian learning is one of the major paradigms. The whole idea that you should, you know, learn the way people do to them is silly. Is, you know, here's Bayes' theorem. Bayes' theorem is like the Newton's laws of machine learning. And then your learning algorithms just derive from Bayes' theorem. And in practice, they could wind up looking very, very different from the way that humans learn. And there's nothing wrong with that because it's artificial learning. It doesn't have to be the same as human. Really, the goal is to learn the things that we want to learn. Whether you do it by being similar to humans or very different is completely up for grabs.
Yeah, and as we're talking through different scenarios here, maybe you can help me understand the relationship of the human with the algorithm and the results of those algorithms. So, I mean, I can clearly see being a benefactor, hopefully I don't have to, but benefactor of research for cancer, right? The ability to select the next book, something interesting there. But those are things helping me make a decision. And I'm wondering how close we get to relying on the algorithms to do things for us. And is there a case where the algorithm has a moment of Alzheimer's? Where we're relying on it and there's a digital Alzheimer's event where it just forgets something or can't remember how to proceed with a particular action.
Yes, unfortunately, learning algorithms can totally have Alzheimer's moments. In fact, there's even a technical term for it. It's called catastrophic forgetting. Now, again, some types of learning don't really have that problem much, like symbolic learning, for example, tends to, because of the way it works, it tends to remember everything you tell it if you want it to remember it. But neural networks, deep networks in particular, are famous for this problem of catastrophic forgetting, which is you teach it something, you teach it to learn, for example, certain kinds of speech from, say, certain people and certain subjects, and it seems to be doing great. And then you start teaching it other things, and it completely forgets the ones. It starts to get worse at the things that it learns first because the new things that it's learning interfere with the old ones. And if you think about it, this is actually a very natural problem to have in learning. And evolution, when it evolved our brains, it figured out a way to deal with this, right? Now, there are some learning paradigms where people still haven't quite figured out how to deal with this. Although, I mean, you know, there's been a lot of progress in deep learning, and these days, to a large extent, I think you can avoid the problem of catastrophic forgetting, but it's not like it can happen. Indeed, it can.
So, in theory, it's great. And I'm a big fan. I mean, I wouldn't do this job if it wasn't. I wasn't a big fan of it. But let's see how, or let's imagine how years from now, and even now, because it's so involved in our everyday life, once people understand, and I know that one of the goal of your book, if not the main goal, is to actually explaining people that this is the reality, and you don't need to know how to program the algorithm as the car. You don't need to know how the engine works, but you need to know how you can brake and how you can start it. And that's it's a metaphor we use quite a bit. So,
and you need to know how to steer it, right? That's the key.
Yeah.
You need to know that there's a steering wheel, and that's the one that you use to, you know, take the car where you want.
Exactly. So by educating at a higher level, the public, what do you see the reaction to be? Like, what do you expect it to be? Because people may be scared of it. Maybe they don't want to accept this. Maybe they'd rather not know that it's there. I mean, I'm going a little philosophical here, but
cool. Yeah. So actually, I think that the opposite will happen. People today are scared of AI because they don't understand what's inside that black box. I think the more people understand it, the less scared they will be and the more confident and the more able to use it, for example, to help them do their job better instead of being afraid that it will take their job, which it probably won't, right? So I actually think it works the other way. And also to get sociological for just a second, one way to look at this is all technology is a form of power. Right? You now have the power to move fast or communicate at a distance or do, you know, remember more things, et cetera, et cetera. And AI is just such a power. It's the power to augment your intelligence, right? It's like power steering, but for your brain. And now the question that you want to ask as an individual and as a society is, who does AI give power to, right? Societies, you know, technology is a driver of change, has been, particularly in the last 200 years. And if you want to see how it's going to change society, you have to ask, who does it give more power to and take power away from, right? You know, in feudalism, whoever owned the land had the power. That's no longer the case, right? Because, you know, there's trade and, you know, shipping and et cetera, right? And now the thing about AI today is that it is giving power to the ones who know how to use it, which for the most part so far are the large companies that have the research labs and et cetera, right? And my contention is that AI should give every one of us power so that you don't feel that AI is taking power away from you. You feel that AI is giving you power instead of giving others powers to manipulate you, right? So you need, you know, everybody needs to have this power, right? As opposed to just being concentrated in a few hands. And, you know, as the saying goes, the world is run by those who show up. And if you don't show up, you know, on this issue of controlling intelligence, the world won't be run by you. So, you know, it's time to learn and start using it.
And I guess a couple things come to mind there. The first is the steering wheel analogy. Well, I don't know where to grab. Where is the steering wheel and where do I grab it? Do I have to ride it 10 and 2, that algorithm? And you say show up and presumably that gives you a voice. And I'm wondering, again, back to the power thing, can an algorithm be controlled by an individual in a way that they can benefit from that? And could it be, and or could it be manipulated by others to do something it shouldn't do?
There's no doubt that it can be controlled, because consider the following analogy, right? We have dogs, right? We have beasts of burden. We have, you know, even the plants that we grow. These are all complex organisms that we actually don't know how they work on the inside, but they still do what we want, right? Because we can train them, and we've had enough, you know, we have enough of a history with them that, you know, you don't lie awake at night worrying that your dog is going to attack you, right? But you don't know what goes inside you. I mean, your dog is a wolf, right? But we've evolved the wolves to do our bidding. Well, if you can evolve wolves to do our bidding to the point where you don't worry, you know, you can sleep next to them with no worries, with more reason can you evolve algorithms and robots to do our bidding, right? This is one aspect. Another aspect, which I think is really key, but, you know, completely invisible to the layperson, is that, to get a little more technical for just a second, in computer science, right, there are the problems that can be solved efficiently and the ones that can't. And the most important famous class is the so-called NP complete problems, which are problems that take an exponential amount of time to solve, but the solutions can be checked efficiently. There's all sorts of examples of this, like the traveling salesman's problem is a simple one. What is the best, you know, route, you know, that touches all these cities? It's very hard to find because there's a big search, but I can easily check whether I have, you know, whether one route is shorter than the other, right? And AI is often defined as, you know, the science of solving NP complete problems using heuristic methods. Heuristic because there is no perfect solution, right? And the key thing about this is that you can put unlimited resources into solving the problem. So the more intelligent the computer is, the better. Our only job is to check the solution, and checking the solution is exponentially easier than solving the problem, right? I mean, in a way, we all know this, because if you think about a company, there's a manager, right? And the manager tells the employee, you know, go do X, Y, Z. And, you know, the manager's going to be there looking over the employee's shoulder the whole time, but then they can check whether the employee did what they wanted or not, right? Or if I, you know, hire a company to do something, right? So this actually happens everywhere. It's just going to happen with machines. We don't know exactly how they're working or how they're doing it in some way that I don't know if an employee is doing exactly what I want, but I can check the solution. And that's actually what my job is, to set the goal, you know, and maybe some constraints, and then check whether, you know, whether the thing that I wanted to get done is being done, then, you know, no bad things are being done, you know, in the process.
And is that the one of the main purposes of the master algorithm, which is to define the goal such that it can be easily measured and checked?
The master algorithm actually has a number of different so we don't know exactly what it is yet, but I think whatever it is, it will have a number of components, right? Or inputs, if you will. One input is obviously the data, right? Another input is the objective, as we said. You know, the same data could be used for different objectives, and it's for the user to set the objective. But a third and the least known but equally important element is the knowledge and the assumptions that go into the algorithm, right? Just saying I have this objective and I have this data actually does not define an algorithm per se, right? It doesn't. There's something else that has to go in there. What goes in there explicitly or implicitly is knowledge, assumptions that I put in. So this is a lot of where we actually interact with the algorithms as designers, right? Is by telling the algorithms the things that I believe or I want it to believe. And again, these days this is done only by experts, and you know, PhD level experts. But it's actually something that should be doable by everybody, right? They should be able to tell Amazon, you know, when I just bought a watch, I'm not looking for another one. This is a silly example, but there's no reason people shouldn't be able to say things like that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That will be, if I think about it, a possible utopia outcome, that will be it, right? You take your data, you change it when you need to, you stop it from other people or company to see it when you don't want to, and at the same time, you benefit from this incredible technology. Well, I think we have bombarded you.
All through an ultimate abstraction layer that has an interface that the common user can access.
I mean, actually, if I had to say, like, what does the utopian outcome of this look like? I think that is AI being almost invisible. These days, AI is very salient in our minds, right, and machine learning. But really, what the ideal future is in some ways is you don't even notice that the AI is there. It's just that the world adapts to you, right? We human beings, what makes us unique is that instead of adapting to the world, we adapt it to us, right? Because we have tools, right? And technology is really just the set of those tools. The thing about machine learning is that it lets you adapt the world to you without even having to do it explicitly. The world just adapts on its own. So yes, all this data is being generated, there's all these sensors and so on, but I don't actually have to worry about that. You know, the world is just better for me than it would be otherwise. And I can tell the world things that I wanted to do, but I don't actually have to worry about what's going on under the hood.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I'm just going to wrap this because we bombarded you with questions and we don't, I know we're capable of keep doing that, but we're going to draw a line here. We hope you'll join us again in the future to cover these and other related topics. And I want to end up, of course, with a call to action for everybody to read this book. Seems to me either you're interested in society, in technology, in computer, or just curious about what happened when you go on Amazon and you figure out that how do they know what I want? They don't know better than me sometimes. We definitely encourage people to read the book. There will be resources in the notes for the podcast, and knowledge is power, Sean.
Absolutely is. And yeah, Pedro, I want to thank you for taking your time to share with us your insights. I mean, a very complex topic, and I think it's easy for people to ignore what they want to be invisible, but I think we have to have some visibility of what's going on, and your book and this conversation will hopefully shed some initial light on that for everybody. So thank you, Pedro.
Yeah, thanks for having you on the podcast.
RSA Security offers business-driven security solutions that provide organizations with a unified approach to managing digital risk that hinges on integrated visibility, automated insights, and coordinated actions. Learn more at rsa.com. Black Cloak provides concierge cybersecurity protection to corporate executives and high net worth individuals to protect against hacking, reputational loss, financial laws, and the impacts of a corporate data breach. Learn more at blackcloak.io. We hope you enjoyed this conversation. If you learned something new and this story made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.